Good morning, Wendy. How are you?
Good, good.
That's good. What's the weather like up there?
Oh, it's beautiful. Just, you know, farm duties, chickens and cows and all that sort of stuff, watering, keeping things alive.
Aren't you lucky?
Been very dry. Been very dry, yeah. Yes, I am.
Yeah, it's a pretty good spot on the planet up there, but you're a long way from the beach, aren't you?
Oh, look, I was never a beach girl. Just cannot... Just lying in the sun never did it for me.
Didn't it?
Too boring.
Okay, fair enough.
Too boring. So how's things with you?
Good, thank you. Yep. Yeah, everything's no problems down here in Adelaide. Beautiful weather today.
Yeah, I guess it's pretty similar weather because it's dry and it gets really hot and a little bit windy. Mm. And I remember that was what Adelaide was like when I was there for a few months.
With Tiger.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Interesting.
Well, yeah. So, yeah, go ahead.
That was one of the reasons I really wanted to talk to you because both of our fathers were involved in the aviation industry. And I was wondering whether that's how you got the bug.
Oh, look, for sure. I ended up doing a live-in, babysitting for my dad. They had no one else, and I was I'd just finished teacher ed, and I was doing working down in Sydney, and he needed a babysitter, and it was school holidays, so I said, yeah, you know, why not? But Dad wasn't around much then in those days. You know, he married another woman and had five kids, but you know, we all get on pretty well. You know, everybody's got their ups and downs and families, but it was just a really And that's really how it started because, although, you know, he used to take us flying. I remember going up to, who was the guy that had who started Hamilton Island? Keith Williams.
Yeah.
Keith Williams taught me to water ski when I was a tiny little kid. And we flew into the ski gardens and, you know, because Dad used to still take us on holidays when we were little. And funny. Look, I can just recall something really funny. Because he opened Lindeman Island. And put the airstrip in there, and you know they cleared area, and that was a pretty luxurious resort in those days. I mean, that was in the mid '60s, and we're up there with Don Chip having a holiday,
okay.
And everybody else had toys to play with in the swimming pool. So Dad said, "We said, well, what are we going to use?" And so he goes and gets the life raft out of the aeroplane and blew it up. So we all played with that in the swimming pool.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, just stuff like that. But the holidays, you know, became less and less. You know, life gets busier and people grow up and, you know, we all go and do different things. But when I went to babysitting the kids when I was about 16, 17, and someone said at the flying school, which was now at Bankstown, hey, come and why don't you have a flying lesson? And I went, oh, all right. But we'd been flying as little kids, you know, sitting on Dad's knee since we were babies.
What sort of aircraft would that have been in?
Oh, Austers. Don't recall a Tiger Moth, but there's a great photo of my brother in a little, I think it's one of the really first 172s that ever came, or 175 that ever came into the country because Dad loved a tailwheel aeroplane. And there's my brother sitting in the aeroplane and you can hardly see him and he's just turned around and someone obviously in the back, you know, taking a photo. And photos in those days, you know, nobody had a camera. Like, I'd never had a camera, took a photo of anything when I was in the early days of flying.
Mm.
Not much at all. And so I blew that up for my brother for his 50th birthday. And I put a little arch around the top. Been in the business a long time because he's an aircraft spray painter up in Gympie now. And it's just a really good photo, black and white. But then there's a movie which I've left in Cambodia with a lot of my stuff because, you know, I was living there doing some flying there and charity stuff. And I left a lot of stuff there because I just haven't gone back. But anyway, that's something to do maybe later this year, but it'll be 4 years
since
all of this rot started.
So you first started to fly when you were 16. You had some lessons at Bankstown.
No, not lessons. Since I was a baby sitting on Dad's lap flying.
Mm.
But as a girl, you know, you're always relegated to the back seat. And my brother, who's only 10 months older than me, he always got the front seat.
Yep. Was that unusual for a female to be learning to fly back then?
Well, since I've been flying now and, you know, in my 60s, I've come across a lot of people. In fact, I came across a woman who's in her 80s and Dad gave her her first flying lesson out of Newcastle.
Wow.
At the Aero Club there. But women pop up everywhere in aviation. I've sort of gone along pretty quietly, you know, done a few amazing things here and there, where I've worked, what I've done, achievements. But the biggest thing has just been doing what I really love. But the disappointment now is, you know, because of the government mandates and particularly Qantas leading the show here, to remove people from the cockpit. No jab, no job.
Mm.
So now I see the woman who was second in charge of Qantas is now running it. I mean, as if it's going to be any different. She's just going to sweep things again under the mat. But anyway, we're not talking about them. But they're apologising to 1,700 workers. You know, no doubt there'll be compensations. But,
that's 1,700 people that have lost their jobs due to the mandates?
Yeah.
That was
in the news yesterday. But look, what's news? The only news I can see is what I know is true and truthful fact and doesn't come from mainstream media. We're all going through quite a few changes in this country, you know, not only aviation, I'm out here now in a very heavy farming community, and some of the things going on out here, our farmers can't even use their water because it might contaminate the Great Barrier Reef, and yet Palaszczuk can mow down hundreds and thousands of acres of farmland where the wash will go, you know, to put up the wind turbines, you know, these ridiculous renewables when there's no such thing as global warming, you know. Ask Mother Nature.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't refer to any scientists about this except the ones that are speaking the truth in the current trends. But the farmers here can't use their water, a lot of them. I go to a lot of events around the place because I'm quite free and I don't have much time now. I've got the farm and I'm actually looking to do a flying job, possibly with a very old aeroplane. I've got to get some more details on it, but it could be a ferry flight coming up with my cousin Jeffrey. So that'll be exciting. But I've still kept a Class 1 medical already. I've applied for so many jobs and every single one of them, are you up to date with your COVID vaccines? I mean, for God's sake, when are these people going to stop the rot? You know? So
what sort of plane is it, the old one?
Well, look, a Bristol freighter. Does that look? Jeffrey just told me yesterday, but I did fly the, believe it or not, the world's first turboprop airline. I most probably the only woman in Australia who has a rating on that aeroplane, and I flew that in the UK.
And what was so special about that?
Well, it was the world's first turboprop airliner, and believe it or not, it was in the drawing board the same time as Concorde. But it was an airliner of superior quality, four engines, Rolls-Royce Dart engines, and I flew it in Africa, up around the northern part of England, and I used to deliver the papers into Belfast, the Isle of Man, and down in Africa we did Guinea-Bissau. The aeroplane was on a wet lease down there, but it didn't last long because I was in the back seat and watched. Unfortunately, they didn't put the aeroplane in the ground idle, and if you don't, you completely melt the engine, and that's what happened. Or it got stuck. I wasn't quite sure what happened, and nobody really wanted to talk about it after that.
What sort of an aircraft was this?
A Vickers Viscount, VC-8. I've actually got one. I've got models in, I call it the hangar in my house, in the farmhouse, which is an old 100-year-old dwelling that's been sort of done up and made of timber on the property, but it's all quite modern looking. But there's some obvious. But in the hangar, I've got every aircraft I flew from the beginning to the end in the livery, and there's about 18 of them up there.
Can you name them?
I can name all of them.
Go on.
Easily. I go through the whole lot. They're all in chronological order. I just have to walk into the room and look at them and tell you. And that's the story. If anybody wants to know my story, there it is.
Yeah, go on then.
Oh, all right. Have we started this already?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We're on.
We're on. All right. Okay, well, starting at the beginning, the first big aeroplane, because I wanted a job as an airline pilot.
Mm.
Not even my own family has an airline that'd give me one.
Okay.
So I decided, Dad said, well, go and prove yourself, girl. And I said, well, what do you recommend? He said, go and find the biggest, heaviest turboprop aeroplane. So I did. And it was the Vickers Viscount. So I was over in the – I just delivered the aeroplane across to Perth, November 7554 Charlie, a Piper Seneca. I flew that solo across the Pacific Ocean. That's a story on its own, which you can come back and ask me later.
Mm-hmm.
But just to finish this one off, so there it is, the VC 813-814, and the company I worked for was called Hot Air, and it was a four-engine turboprop, 1,910 shaft horsepower Rolls-Royce. And moving on then, that company split and formed and got a Boeing 737-200 series, and they were called Trans-European Airways. So I went to work for them, and we also went up to Papua New Guinea on a wet lease, but that happened to be during the airline pilot strike here in the late 80s, I think it was. And, of course, you know, I was targeted as a scab, but we were flying and demonstrating the aeroplane for, it was a wet lease, you know, Boeing were involved in it. But it was a very complicated wet lease because it was America, because we were flying to Guam, the island, and then back into Papua New Guinea and Australia. So that was only 3 months, and then I went back to the UK. But that was the same aeroplane. And then the Gulf War came, and that was the end of flying jets around, because that company all went bankrupt. And we'd sit on the ground, and that stage, you know, I'd been married for about a year to a UK guy who's currently the Viscount of Rugby, but we're no longer married anymore. But anyway, that's another story.
Hmm.
And then I resurrected my aviation career with Impulse Airlines. I actually had 10 years off because I had a baby. Travel around the world. We lived all over, like France and Germany, with the British Army, and in America, where I gave birth to a very beautiful girl, and she's now 27. So I had a 10-year gap, stayed home, army wife, being mum, but always doing flying wherever I was. Even in Germany, I was doing some flying there, but just you know, with a local flying school. And then I came back to Australia, and Impulse gave me a job, which was really good. But after a year working for them on the Beechcraft 1900, the McGowan, who owned it, set up a deal and got three Boeing 717s. What a beautiful air. It was a DC-9. With a glass cockpit,
okay,
but with the engines in the back. But what a beautiful aeroplane. So, and I was the lucky last to go onto the aeroplane. But, you know, the company was a great company, and it did as good as it could. Even some of the pilots had to become flight attendants. I remember, I won't mention his surname, but Harry will know if he ever hears this. But he came, the flight pilot, captain, became a flight attendant.
Wow.
Under the new banner, which was, of course, Impulse. And, of course, that was to be the forerunner of Jetstar. So, but during Impulse with the 717, 200 series, I'm just counting up the liveries. So there was it had three liveries. It was Impulse paints, and then they painted it with the cockatoo on the back, and then it became Qantas Link with the kangaroo. So I've still got the Qantas shares they gave me. They could certainly have all those back. I'll donate them to some charity. Nothing to do with them anymore until they get someone who knows aviation people to run that airline like it should be run.
Yeah.
Not run into the ground. And that nasty, foul-mouthed little Irishman, I hope he disappears. So moving on from that one, that became QantasLink, and then it became Jetstar. But Jetstar never operated the 717. But being such a great aeroplane, and, you know, someone in Qantas had some initiative to keep it because beautiful to fly. It had some problems in the beginning because the engine, the system was so automated and the – you know, just one little computer software problem and an engine would detect a problem and it would shut down that engine. You had no say in it.
Mm.
Anyway, I was in an aeroplane when that happened and I was first officer then and captain did a really good job managing it all, and that was down in Hobart. So bases all over the place. And then when it became Jetstar, I got my endorsement on the Airbus A320. And that was in Brisbane, and 6 years with Jetstar, moving all over the place. And then I decided I didn't want to work for Jetstar anymore. Management, you know, there are things happen in aviation, and the management, you know, from the pilot strike, a lot of things changed in aviation. And some people that should have never had jobs as pilots got jobs as pilots, and then they moved up through the ladder because, you know, they were the people that went back to work. And poor managers. So anyway, my decision to leave Jetstar. And
was Jetstar part of Qantas then?
Well, it always was.
Okay.
But a lot of people didn't really know that.
Mm.
And then I'm sitting at home and I get a phone call from this guy, Mark. I mean, I guess I can say, you know, I better not say surnames in case people... don't know, you know, don't want people to know. But anyway, Mark calls me and he says, why don't you come and work for us? We're going to start a new airline in Australia. And I went, oh, I'm all for that. Because most of my career, except, you know, Impulse has started, I've done startup airlines. And through no fault other than world crisis have these companies not been successful. But they've all, you know, had wonderful people in there. You know, and when you handpick your people initially, you're going to get a good job. So I ended up going to Singapore, writing manuals here and there. Had to do the Singapore license. Oh, boy, going back to licenses, UK license. Always kept my Aussie license and medicals current. And then Tiger Airways had the A320s. So, and ended up starting in Singapore for about 6 months. And then we started up and brought the airline here and launched it very successfully because I think we were the first ones who started charging for luggage and charging for everything.
Mm.
So, you know, that's the way it goes. If you can make a buck and give people a cheap seat and they can make the choices, then that's what it's all about to keep aviation going. And Tiger Airways, great livery, great company. Singapore, incredibly well managed. And then, of course, it was going so well, I think Qantas put the knife in and, you know, like they've done to Emirates through letting the government say, oh, no, we don't like something here. So Tiger was shut down for a short period. But there were some marvellous people, the chief pilot, Captain Derek, I won't mention his name, but, you know, held a team together, got things back up and running, and Tiger got airborne again. So I ended up doing about 6 years with Tiger, and after my daughter finished school, I went, oh, it's time to just take a bit of a break again. But no break was had. I ended up in the Philippines. Well, before that, I took off to China, and I was looking, no, hang on, it was the Philippines first. So I decided to have a holiday there. And someone said, I'll come and, you know, met some bloke and said, come work for us. And I was actually got a job there, and I was flying seven Airbus A320s, 321s and 319s. And we were going, some of the flying there was absolutely outrageous. I mean, one flight up to Korea, the end of a Typhoon Queenie it was, volcanic ash to avoid on the way, de-icing at Incheon Airport, and then coming back into the tail end of the typhoon again. That was a massive day's flying. I can say that that was about the biggest flight I've had in my life. Oh, no, there have been others, but that one was awesome. That involved an overnight in Incheon where we normally do. So did a couple of years there, set up a charity business making clothes, met some wonderful people, and we were making swimwear and setting up sewing business. And I thought, well, this is great, you know, because why not do something, you know, in the Philippines? And it is a very beautiful place. And also set up, you know, cleaning the beaches up, a few things to do with, you know, just helping people, and then animal rescue. And it just goes on and on there. But anyway, you get sort of island fever. And then I thought, right, need to go to the mainland. So like everyone else was heading to China, and I thought, oh, well, I'll just follow some of these mad Mexican people I'd met and headed off to China. So Shenzhen. And lasted about 6 months there. Didn't like it. Couldn't do it anymore. So I left there.
What was the problem with working in China?
Working in China, how can I say it? Very complicated. Like, I'm sitting in the back of an aeroplane doing some training, and the poor first officer, he didn't have the right screen up for takeoff. So the training captain picked up a manual and slapped him over the back of the head with it.
Mm.
And the poor guy was doing the takeoff, and I thought he was going to pass out. So, you know, I don't like that sort of brutality.
No.
And as I'm a guest in their country, I didn't challenge it, but I did give the guy a hug after.
And, you know, good on you.
You know, very quietly. And, so then after that, came back to Australia, you know, where I always do, and regroup, and decided, oh, well, where else can I go? And there'd been a job I'd been looking at in Cambodia, working, you know, with the Cambodian royal family and other connections, but very Chinese influenced. And but the major influence comes from Vietnam and the training. But what an airline it turned out to be. Cambodia Anchor Air, the most beautiful people, and that was the top job. That was a job that everyone said, gosh, if you get that, you know, you're set for life. And it was. It was commuting 6 weeks on, 2 weeks off, and they were the most incredible people and professional. The cabin crew, out of all the airlines, I would say they would rate as 9.5 out of 10.
Wow.
And any problems, they just, you know, in fact, my first year, if I got it up here, I got a first, within a year I was there, they gave me Certificate of Reward, Outstanding Staff of the Year, level one, tireless efforts, noble dedication, and lasting contributions to the company operations.
Hmm.
So, yeah, so I thought that was a pretty good thing.
Was that still an airline?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah,
but everything, it changed, you know, when the airline shut down at the beginning. I think it was 2021. Was that when all this started?
2020.
Yeah, and I came back in March, but I'd set up a sewing business. I had a whole house on two levels, and the top bit was dedicated to teaching sewing for the locals, and I had all the machines, and we were making aprons, we were making tablecloths, and I had a great business there in all the hotels and also working with people resurrecting the silk trade, because they make a lot of their silk there. They actually weave it and dye it, and we're using some really extraordinary methods that the Japanese had created, along with some very old traditional Cambodian methods. But look, it's all still there. I just need to get back. But life, you know, that's the aviation. So
It is.
I did thousands of hours there, and they got three major airports in Cambodia, and Sihanoukville's one, and Siem Reap, which is where I lived, and Phnom Penh. But it's aviation there is very well run, and safety was never compromised. In fact, one flight, I did the PA, and some people came up to the cockpit after, and it was the guy whose mother's table I'd broken when I was 18. I sat on a glass table, And she said, "You breaking any glass tables lately?" I said, "Oh no." I mean, isn't that just you know, out of you know, but there are a lot of tourists that come in and out, and just meeting people here and there, and particularly aviation people. The good people tend to stay in contact. But since coming back, I've had to sell the property that I had a mortgage on just to exist, because I could see that this rubbish from the government and how they're selling it to the people was just not going to go away.
Mm.
And lucky for me, I made the decision not to get jabbed, purely because of the basic information that my daughter had given me about some things that she'd read, and she had some proof. And particularly, you know, where they get the, how they make a lot of the vaccines. And I just went, wow.
So your daughter was the one that highlighted it to you. Otherwise, she would have gone ahead with it.
I was happy to go. And I was going to go back to the job. Didn't think anything about it. That, you know, because I've been vaccinated with other vaccines, the smallpox and, you know, the rubella one they give for women. But my daughter was lucky, because she, when she was born, we lived in so many different countries, she hardly got any.
Mm.
So in her immunisation schedule. But did you know that the government here penalise people because you don't jab your kids?
Yes, no jab, no play. So you can't go to kindergarten.
And
you
no can't, pay, and you can't no go to, play.
Yeah, you can't no go pay. To daycare. So the mother doesn't get any rebate.
Yeah.
So she's punished.
So that's it. So I'm opening up my property here to give people some support, you know, a bit of country life, especially for mums. And I've now got 21 campsites here.
Wow.
And I'm with Hip Camp. But look, getting back to the property that I developed over 20 years on the Sunshine Coast, magnificent. And but I had a mortgage. And who's going to pay the mortgage when you know, and I cannot get a job. I've applied in Bunnings. I've applied for maybe 20 flying jobs, nearly every airline in Australia. Got to be jabbed. And Bunnings won't even let me pass the front door, because in all their questionnaires they are, you know, what's your COVID, what's your vaccination status for on the COVID. Some of them, you know, they're that smart, you know, and I cannot lie. And I was offered – pay $1,500. This is a bit of a shocker. I don't know if you know about this, but there are people out there flying. Yes, they have a job, but they have a fake vaccination certificate that says in their records that they have had the jab when they haven't.
Yeah. Now, what do you reckon the percentage is of that?
I would say 10% of people flying.
Mm.
But, you know, I won't mention names, and I will never, ever betray anybody who's told me about this, and I know it's fact, and I just can't do that, because in last year, in 2021, I ran in the federal election for the House of Representatives for Fairfax, and I represented the Informed Medical Options Party, which has changed their name now, the Heart Party, and our policy, you know, was truth, accountability, integrity. And how could I possibly do something like that? And that's the problem. You cave in, and too many people did it, no matter what they did, because families have to be fed. I understand that people have to make these decisions, but you know, you can always go and get another job. However, it has proved extremely difficult when it comes back to it. You know, what else? I mean, I can do lots of things, but working in an office, I don't think I'd last long. So I went and did a horticulture course, courtesy of the government, and a parks and garden. And I keep applying for jobs, but there's no jobs around here local. I got one just when I was leaving the Sunshine Coast. But where I am now is South Burnett area. So, you know, I've got this beautiful 20 acres here. But the other property I sold, I sold that one, paid the mortgage off, and bought a house in Nambour. Well, that lasted about 6 months, so I couldn't stand suburbia and the neighbours, and of course all the 5G that they've now put up everywhere. Absolutely shocking there. So I thought, well, I'll go bush. So waited 12 months, sold the property, and then but it did take me a year to find something, and I found it's a fair way away from the coast, 2.5 hours, but this beautiful rural property. And last week, well, it's 20 acres, it was an old dairy farm, but last week I had a mate here and he's got model aeroplanes and we were glider flying. So that was incredible, you know, and he was launching them, but had to watch the dog because they're incredibly light composite. And I've just got this little Kelpie puppy dog and she was very keen to chew it up. But, and then I had someone clear some paddocks here. Oh, well, just mow the grass down, not clear because I'm not allowed to do that. And I reckon I've got enough room for an airstrip. We just have to fill one gully in. So, but the airstrip, there's an airstrip in town and it's only 4 minutes away. Perfect. So I guess I'd rather spend the money on the infrastructure here for people who need a bit of a break.
Mm. Just going back to the pilots flying with the jab, how many of them do you think you're going to line up again when the government brings in another mandate?
Well, those with the jab will... It's like I can give you an example. My cousin, I won't mention his name, but he's had 5.
Mm.
Now, like Pfizer, did they give them a placebo vaccination? I think that's entirely probable, particularly with this particular overseas airline, because they're smart.
Mm.
And he said he's had no one from where he is in Hong Kong get sick that he's know of. But in Australia, yes, there's been a long list of pilots. And they're now, I don't know if you're aware, or you would, Captain Graham Hood.
Yep.
I'll still call him Captain because he'll be called that forever, because he's become one of the greatest advocates for honesty and integrity and accountability in Australia. Along with others, but being in, you know, the main one for aviation when he's got his program club grubbery with Johnny, they're amazing what they've come out with. But yeah, there will be people who will line up, and I think you'd agree that this is, you know, it's the mass hypnosis. I don't have I have a television here, and it has a painting in front of it.
Mm, good one.
That's my idea of a perfect television.
Yeah.
And it's the brainwashing, and people need to wake up, because there's the, you know, but they throw so many things at us. You know, we've got this voice campaign, which everyone out there should be voting no, because it is divisive. We are all one now, and we do not need, nobody needs one voice more than the other.
Mm.
But what the government needs to do is listen to people, and they're not doing that. But that's all I'll say on The Voice, because it's created a lot of division already.
Yeah, totally.
And I'm not a favour of the government at all. And I've done some pretty good reading over the last 3 years on a lot of stuff. But one thing I did do that I'm very pleased with, apart from a little bit of 172 flying here and there and keeping that Class 1 medical renewed every 6 months, boy, and it's so expensive.
Yeah, that's ATPL, isn't it? Airline Transport License.
Yeah, ATPL, and when you're over. But you see, Australia, and I made the decision to stay here, partly because I couldn't get out, but then the reality is I'm now too old to go back to my job.
Mm.
But the pay is $800 US a month.
Mm.
That's the pay. But there, you know, Going back now, in Asia, you know, expat pilots were overpaid for years. And how would you like to be a local? You know, like here I am in my country and they bring a foreigner in and he gets 5 times the salary.
Yeah.
It's wrong.
Mm.
And I always believe everybody, no matter whether you're male or female, whatever the colour, whatever you know, if you're doing the same job, you get the same pay.
Should be.
So, but I was a little bit unpopular, as you can imagine, with the expats when I talked like that.
Mm.
And it's happened. Now, salaries, $800 US.
Yeah, all right.
It's all gone back to local pay.
Mm.
But the airline's doing well, and I'm still in correspondence with them. But I'm, of course, now too old to be flying. But Australia, I can still fly.
Mm, yeah.
They'll still let me, you know, and I'll be happy as a first officer. If anyone's out there and needs a pilot, no accident, no incident, a perfect flying record. I have challenged, though, management on numerous occasions.
No doubt.
Just like my dad,
mm.
but all for the benefit of others.
How many hours have you got in your logbook?
About 16,000.
Wow.
And
that's a long time sitting on your bottom, isn't it?
Yeah, 42 years with 10 years off, you know, in the last 3 years. Although I did a flight, picked my brother's a spray painter, Hubo, up, and he has a business up at Gympie Airport, built a hangar, and he's just done remarkable work for himself. Another brother's a spray painter at Bankstown Airport. But Hubert painted this 182 fixed gear. And magnificent paint job, and it had to go to Darwin. So one day's notice, and he says, come on, let's take it up. So up I went, and we just went, no flight plan. did whatever was required in the airspace to meet the obligations. And 2 days later, we arrived in Darwin, just in a little private airstrip outside Darwin. And the biggest storm the biggest storm I've seen in the last few years here in Australia. And we just got in.
Wow.
But anyway, I had a hailstorm here last Friday, and it was white. It was, you know.
Like snow.
Yeah, jingle bells.
Wow.
Yeah.
Just to go back to your license. So that's ATPL license, which enables you to fly an airliner multi-engine, multi-crew,
IFR. Yes.
So it's the highest licensing you can get.
The absolute in Australia. And I've got one of those for the UK. I've got a commercial in America. I have a Singapore ATPL. I have, what else have I got? The UK license. I mean, wow. That was a doozy to get.
As far as these licensing, are they all the same in that you need to comply by a drug and alcohol policy?
Oh, it's all those standards are set by the International Civil Aviation Organization, and Australia's a member. But then they have the ESA have theirs, and yes, drug and alcohol testing. I think that was brought in maybe 10, 15 years ago. But I've turned up at Incheon Airport, for example, and we were drug and alcohol tested, which is absolutely fair and reasonable. But they do that, and yet can put this unknown substance into your body.
Well, you're not allowed to take codeine, but you're allowed to take an experiment that's been made in a day.
I tell you what, CASA here and FAA in America, which is what they base everything on, but CASA has to answer for what it's done.
Their answer to it is that we're going to treat it like any other vaccine and you can't fly for 24 hours.
But it's not a vaccine. We know that. But look, that's an entirely, you know, people have been debating this for 3 years.
But, what do you think the pilots that have maybe got fake vaccine certificates are going to do when the CASA says you can't fly if you've been vaccinated?
Well, that's what I told them. But the one guy who was very, you know, very nice, didn't really know me, but said, look, I can help you out here. And I said, well, what are you going to do? And CASA turns around and I said, it's inevitable that the truth will be revealed about all this, which it is now. It's just a matter of people turning off the television and listening to people who are telling the truth, not the paid media. And I said, what happens when CASA says, you've been jabbed now, you can't fly, you'll have to, but they're making in America, they're making some of the airlines pilots do these myocarditis tests, which, you know, here, I guess if you have to do the tests involved here, you know, it'd be about, you know, 2,500.
Yeah.
But lucky for me, I never did it. And I actually owe that to my daughter, but that was, it was a very, very tough decision. But you know, then again, people have to, you know, got to feed their families, pay mortgages, But the cost of living in Australia, everything has just gone crazy here. But these people who orchestrated all of this, this is the fake, you know, the COVID drug itself and indoctrination. These people are moving for more. They're just setting up. That's just a playground for what they really want.
It's topsy-turvy, isn't it?
Yeah, the voice is part of it. And if people haven't figured that out, the allegiance to foreign powers, be they bureaucrats or multi-corporate companies owning nearly every part of Australia. Like, you look at someone sent me something yesterday, and I went, you know, and anything I get, I research myself. Sometimes it's very hard to get the information. But any company like Woolworths, who do you reckon is behind Woolworths?
Probably BlackRock or Vanguard.
Yeah. Qantas?
Same.
Coles?
Same.
Bunnings, you know, it just goes on and on and on. And it's like the I have about 100 core flutes. You know what those are? They're the signs that, you know, they started, you know, where you put up the side of the road for political campaigns.
Yep.
And I've had a lot of those done, and I've done a lot of rallies. But up here I thought, well, I've got to do something. So I walk around the streets in Kingaroy Friday with whoever wants to turn up, and we offer to be the information that people are censored from.
Great idea.
And I bring this wonderful newspaper in with Deborah Yule, who's the lady, or I've mentioned, so she won't mind, from Exit the Who. And that's the Canadian guy, James Radowski or something like that. But that's a deadline coming up. I think it's the 27th, or it's any day now.
Most Australians don't know about our attachment to the Who.
Well, basically anyone listening wants to know. Our government's selling us out to the World Health Organization. They managed the last pandemic. If you think they did a good job, well, you do nothing. If you don't do something, they will manage, create another pandemic. No doubt Mr. Gates will have another financial gain and a few others. And more lockdowns, more loss of jobs, more tragedies, and they're selling out Australia. And if you don't comply, they've already allowed the UN in here. They passed that one in Parliament. They have unlimited access to any mental facility.
Mm.
So political dissidence is considered a mental illness, or they're trying to get that one in if it's not already. So they're just going to lock up. And we know about the press censorship now.
Mm.
I mean, look at the censorship and the ridiculous nonsense that's gone on with this voice. I said I wasn't going to say anymore, but that money that has been wasted on splitting up Australia, which is all it will achieve, and it's done that already, but it's going to be up to people like Jacinda Price and the likes of her, and, you know, Pauline's behind, and I just wish all the good people could get in a room and get together and come up with the solutions. The old two-party politics system, they're all sellouts. And
it doesn't work?
Nope, doesn't work. We need something new. And it's like, I think that, okay, here's a radical step for me, having, you know, looked at politics. I think that government should be run, our country should be run locally in our areas by local government.
Mm.
And then we have one body that oversees all that. I'd like to see all the multi-corporate mining, any mining, come back into Australia and Australians. Nobody can own a mine anymore.
Mm.
The multi-corporates and that can all go. Clive Palmer, I'm sorry, Clive, but you'll lose out, but I think you've made enough money. And I think all our wealth should be distributed back into Australia, and we should start building up our own independence from the rest of the world, because our governments over the last 30 years have made us sellouts. We have nothing anymore. We don't even produce our own fuel. We have to import it. Car industries and paper, the last paper mill closed. So things are rotten in the state of not Denmark. As old Mr. Will Shakespeare said, they're rotten in the state of Australia, the whole state, the whole country.
Mm.
And it needs a good clean-up.
Well said.
Right. Right.
I've got to take my hat off to Clive Palmer, though, for buying enough hydroxychloroquine for the whole of Australia.
Yeah, but they took it off him.
They did.
He was never allowed to distribute it. But he was successful in getting Peter McCulloch. Now, you've just come up. Peter McCulloch, I met him up at Twin Waters because he organised, it was his aeroplane that got Pierre Corey and the other wonderful people out here. And that man, the protocols he wrote for this flu-type virus, manufactured virus.
Treatment protocols.
Treatment protocols.
Yep.
Were simply amazing. Mm. And, you know, really, and I met him up at Twin Waters when he was doing the speech up there and doing his tour around Australia. And I managed to get 2 seconds with, while everyone was taking a selfie, I bought this newspaper, I don't think I've mentioned yet, called The Light Australia.
Yeah, it's a great paper,
isn't it? Heard about it?
Mm.
20,000 copies a year ago. It's now had 1 million copies distributed by volunteers all around Australia.
It How good is that?
It's the unsense of truth. So I got him, he had a look at it, and I said, I don't want a selfie, but I just, would you hold this up? This is our only truthful source of information in Australian newspaper. He looked at it, must be a super quick reader, and he said, I like this one. And he put it up in front of him, and that was it. So that sent off a whole chain of events with the newspaper, and, you know, had to have someone of that caliber. And myself and Deborah now in the last order, paper comes about every 6 weeks. We get it shipped over, which we pay for ourselves, and then we use volunteers to distribute it. But we bought over 20,000 papers nearly.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's
and
great.
And they go, yeah, so, and everywhere around he knows about it. This is South Burnett, and it is really an amazing part of Australia.
I've never been there.
Very happy to be living here, and I'm quite close to town, but I'm just setting up something that'll be nice for a lot of people to enjoy.
Mm.
Particularly my...
Go on.
Sorry? No, yeah, my daughter, and I've got two beautiful grandchildren.
How good are grandchildren?
Can't get enough of them. I'm going on Monday just to babysit. So I drive 2.5 hours there, 2.5 hours there. But on the way, I'm staying with my cousin Jeff. He's got an airstrip at Caboolture. That's called Hazelton, YHAZ, if anybody ever needs to know.
Okay.
Just north of Brisbane, the Glasshouse Mountains. And that's where the 172 is that I use, that's his son. And we fly that around everywhere. And, in fact, that's how I ended up here. I came to do a talk with Captain Graham Hood and Captain Derek Fox. And I loved the area so much and found the people so responsive. But they're all actually, they're quiet people, because mainly country people, but they're fed up. They're fed up with the government. They're fed up with the stupid rules. The agriculture, like the latest, here's the latest one. I went to a talk here a couple of weeks ago. Well, not a talk, to talk to people about the Verona mite. Now, this is a mite that I reckon was, whether it came here accidentally or not, it is now been required to destroy the millions and millions of little bees. Now,
why?
What's going to happen when we don't have any bees?
We'll be in trouble.
That's the end of us, because there's no, the bees travel from plant to plant. They do their fertilising stuff, and the crops are going to be less and less. But they're saying that the bees now have to be destroyed. And I told this guy, I said, this government is, and this all started in north of, there was a lady called Kate Mason who was running an IMOP, and now she started a group of people down there, and she's trying to work with the local government. And they just went in and were burning people's beehives, even if they had no sign of the Veronamite. Now, this is a bug that can devastate, but what's far more devastating is the thing that's happening in our country. They look for the destruction before they look for a cure. And this, you can say that about the vaccine. They want to kill and maim and then try and retract from that. And for some of these decisions, you know, people with vaccinations and whether it's the bees and the veronamite, there's no comeback.
It just seems like there's almost too much going on that you can't, like your head swiveling going, that's a problem, and there's everything's a problem.
Well, because that's the way they've made it, and they've made it so people have to concentrate on their day-to-day living. Like if you've got a mortgage,
you don't know any of this.
No, it's terrifying.
It's too hard.
Too hard. Scary. But look, getting back to the local people, they are very responsive when I took a space at the market a couple of months back, and they have a market once a month, and I had just information about 5G, core fruits around. We had the light newspaper, and we were swamped. I ended up giving away 500 newspapers that day.
That's encouraging.
And people were thirsty. Mm. So last week was the closing date for the councillors. You have to do a councillor's course, and that closes 6 months. So if anyone wants to be a councillor, sorry, you've now missed because it's in March next year, and I'm seriously contemplating or considering running in the local council here for the next election in March.
It's probably the only way.
Well, there's a lot of things that can be done. Around here, I go to a lot of meetings and try and understand the worst of what's going on here. But in the area, South Burnett, which joins on to Wide Bay, Madame Palaszczuk from Brisbane to Cairns is set up all these renewable energy projects. The Barumba project is in the middle of a national park. Now, she wants to put, it's a hydro, pumped hydro. Have you heard of this?
No.
It pumps water from one level to another. And as it goes down, it pumps up. It's got turbines. So anything that goes into the turbines, so this is a river that's fed off the Mary River and other rivers, it just churned. And this happens again and again and again. Now, the logistics of getting these turbines from Brisbane Port here on the roads is like, what are they going to do with all the used electric car batteries? Oh, nobody's real. Oh, well, we're working on that. You know, that sort of thing. So that's one project. So I'm going to a meeting about that. And I see even the local David Littleproud. Oh, he's not Labor. He's some Liberal National Party. He was at the ABC. I did watch the ABC with Jacinta Price talk. Oh, gosh, I tell you what, if anybody wants to watch, it's on YouTube. The Jacinta Price, her latest talk about getting back, I said I wasn't going to say the voice, but you know, getting back about why we should vote no.
It was brilliant.
But, the Barunda project is in the midst, and the area is beautiful. It's the Bunya Mountains areas. It's part of the Great Dividing Range. And then all around that, she's got the biggest wind turbine project. Now, you know who owns all the, and who's the boss behind, the corporate head behind all the wind turbines in Australia?
No.
Mr. Forrest.
Mm.
So he should be the wealthiest man in Australia. He should be giving the philanthropist, as he's called, and it's all his company that's building all the, and they're building the biggest one, 776 million or billion, anyway, millions have become billions, haven't they, in the local area here. They're closing down the coal. In fact, they're going to bulldoze them in. The coal, there's two coal, what do they call them, mines or, you know, the produce energy, power stations.
Mm.
Yeah, and there's two of those, and they employ about 300 or 400 people. But where she wants to bulldoze these in. There's enough coal for another 100 years there and put up wind turbines. Bulldoze the landscape, make sure it's not too high so aircraft, you know, don't crash into them, and devastate it. No, too bad for the Barrier Reef. And that's all in the catchment area that's, you know, they won't let the farmers use some of their water. So she's got that project. And then the third one is the heat-producing solar farms. Beautiful farmland, and the temperature around those in summer up 10 degrees. Now, those projects she's got all the way up up the east coast and inland to here, to as far as Dalby and even further inland. So the whole of central Queensland to the coast is because of this super city that she's producing. And this super city, I got a map here, and she says jobs. For instance, the wind turbine, 300-400 jobs it produces, enough power for all the area. When the turbines are up, how many jobs do you think it will supply? They bring foreign labour in to build it all. How many jobs do you think it'll create at the end of it?
Yeah.
10. And she's got here, I'm just reading off the spoof, the Queensland super grid providing power and for generations. I suggest anyone out there wants to really know what's going on with the tax-paying dollars and the money that they keep borrowing that we're never going to pay back. And as far as that one goes, we just tell them, go bankrupt and start again.
Mm.
The whole country should go bankrupt and we start again. We get good people in, like Gerard Rennick, who knows how to manage money. Anyway, this is queensland.gov.au/energy-and-jobs-plan. It's $11.6 million worth of lies, and it just goes on and on. And you should see, it goes out Mount Isa, it starts in Brisbane, and it's for the a super grid. Now, those three types of renewable energies, which are not renewable energy, because we know there's no such thing as global warming, that's just all hype, they need power lines. And this is the problem now. It becomes the whole of Queensland, over half of Queensland, is going to be covered in a grid. And how ugly are those things? And who wants to live near them?
No one.
They will make 5G look like a lollipop.
Mm.
So it is unbelievable. Now, of course, I've asked to be on the committee for the Barumba pumped hydro, so we'll see what happens there. But there's another meeting on Sunday, and that's what I do with my time. And then I'll see Jeffrey. We're going to talk about this aeroplane that needs to be ferried, and then I'm going up to pick up a portaloo because just need one on the property here for the people when they stay, so it's not too much work on the septic system. And I'm also picking up a shower, a shower that I got off Facebook. So life's very busy, it's very full, and I'm happy, but and then Jeffrey said to me, well, you don't have time for a flying job, but if anyone wants to give me a job, I'd love it. There's one company in Australia who have said yes, but they can't get me, and I'm waiting, you know, to see if I can get a job with them because the course is in America.
Okay.
And now they've dropped the vaccine requirements for people. I can go and do it, but there's so no courses available.
That's a simulator course?
Yeah, it's a simulator course for a jet.
Mm.
And that's a good, useful job because it'll be fire spotting. And,
okay. Right.
I think, you know, and I want to do something useful.
Mm.
But with all the expertise I've got for aviation, and this is what we're going to miss, these airplanes, they are so automated now. And the Airbus, you couldn't get a safe aeroplane. But when things go wrong, it's like you got to sometimes think outside the box, even though the box says it's got all the answers. And it's like these. There's some guy in America now, someone sent me, where he's a totally non-piloted that can take four passengers.
Yeah, I don't think many people will sign up to go on that plane.
Yeah, it'll be like the same. I always tell the joke, you know, welcome aboard the first automated non-piloted flight. Hope you have a pleasant trip. Anyway.
During the last few years, have you felt alone?
Never. It's like when I said I can't lie on the beach. My brain just the only time, and that's why I sleep always so well. Because you just got to think what's ahead, what can you do? And I've got to get some emails out today, really important ones, to tell people about the World Health Organization. And I'll take some flyers on Sunday, and I've got to plan all that and the logistics and the march on Friday when we go around the street. Come on, you know, and I'll be taking Exit the Who. And I've on my little card I carry around, no vote. But never a dull moment. If you sit and you think and you worry, you're going to get sick.
Mm.
Now, during all of this, I'm sure I got this flu-type thing 3 or 4 times. And but living in Asia for off and on for quite a bit, I think I got a pretty strong resilience, because the people like in Cambodia, you don't see people with snotty noses and running around and sick. It just, there's just something about a hot environment that I think is naturally healthy. You know, their skin, they don't get cancers. You know, what we get cancers now from is the pharmaceutical company, you know, selling us drugs that give us cancer to protect us from getting cancer. Anyway, don't get me going on drug companies.
Don't get me started.
Yeah, don't get me started.
Have you been angry?
Oh, I get so angry at the stupidity. And particularly, I have to say, my worst anger was with my own family. When my mother wouldn't see me because I'd just come back from Cambodia and I wasn't jabbed. And she thought I was going to give her some terrible disease. But she now, after 3 years, I mean, we're talking about someone who, if it's black, it's black, and it's white, it's white. And she doesn't bend. But I've been giving her copies, leaving them around of the Light newspaper, because she used to turn on and watch that Kosh Channel 9 filthy station, and got brainwashed, totally brainwashed. Loved him. And in the end, she said, I'm glad that, I won't say what she called him, is gone. She said, he's a liar and a thug.
Well
said. And that's what she summed up about him. And then she says, and I went up, she said, and the doctor, but she, you know, believes still in the flu jab, but she said, told him, she said, you're not giving me any more of that stuff.
So do you think this is through your talking to her and giving her the Light newspaper and stuff like that, she's turned around?
Just a small...
How good's that?
Yeah, and my sister won't. My brother, he is so dirty on doctors for various things, so he just doesn't want to borrow them. And I doubt whether he'll have any more, because, you know, he sat with me in an aeroplane when we went up to Darwin, you know, Mount Isa and Darwin, and that was, you know, 12 hours. And, you know, you can just a few subtle things without, then he'd put his hand up and then I'd know that's enough. And then I'd, you know, then you'd come in another door and later and say, you know, there's a lot of help out there, and, you know, if you ever need any advice, hand up again. But, you know, you plant a seed. And that's the government never gave anyone a chance to plant a seed, except those who in the beginning got some very basic information. And
that's all there was, wasn't it? Basic.
Basic. But to sell, you know, that, but they had all these vaccines figured out back in 2017 or 18. They'd all been pre-ordered, and the money that's wasted on it. And I think there needs to be accountability before I'll be satisfied. My anger is with the government day after day, telling people, lying to the people, telling the people what they, and then getting big corporate business to do the dirty work for them, passing the buck halfway through through an election from Liberal, from Morrison to
the current clown.
I can't even speak his name.
Same.
Albert Nasty, we'll call him. I mean, it just, but people need to wake up. This government doesn't work for us anymore. And you know, my statement about them being, what is that? It's bearing close resemblance to the beginnings of communism.
Totally. Do you think that people have lost the art of paying attention to their intuition?
Yeah, I think, and a lot of that is, you know, getting back to a flying terminology, if you don't have common sense, you can't, you know, a long time, and students that I've taught, you're teaching them just common sense. And the government does not have common sense, because they use our money and our goodwill, and they're supposed to represent us, but they use it against us in every way possible. I don't think there's any facet of our lives that they've missed so far. You know, they've come into the home. That first of all, it was the invasion into the medical care, which is not care. It couldn't care less. Then they've gone into the schools to control that. No wonder there's so much homeschooling now. My daughter, just, you know, my daughter will never send her kids to mainstream school.
I can see why.
Yeah. But, you know, we all have to work with each other. You can't be at each other, you know, and people have differing opinions. And I think that if you can engage someone in a very simple conversation like, how are you going today? And when I walk through town, I'll say, you know, do you know about The Voice? And nearly everyone knows about it. And everybody, bar one person over the last 2 months in Kingaroy, have said they're voting yes.
Nearly everyone?
Only one person.
Oh, only one.
They're all no voters. Mm. No, no, no. Mm. And I say, well, how did you come to that decision? And the very basic understanding is we're all equal now. A no vote will ensure that we remain equal and we are not divided. It's that simple.
Mm. Yeah, well, it seems to be.
But even old blimey old Albert, when he was interviewed, he goes, oh, it's only one page.
Well, given that he won't give all the information, then how can you make an informed decision?
No, because underlying it, of course, is the World Economic Forum.
That's right.
And if you don't know about what they're up to,
go look it
have
up.
Have a look at the nasty things that have gone on with children and this identification of who you are today. I mean, that is just crazy.
It is.
But again, all that was divisive. Mm. Everything is divisive that the government comes up with.
So clever.
To create disunity in the family. If you can break up the family, then I reckon they think that's the goal, because in the end they want us to have nothing and be happy.
Mm.
And that's not me, and I'll fight for that. Every last breath in me will fight against us being a digital one world order.
We're lucky to have you.
Yeah, you can't beat this country and the people, and this is what they, you know, we all know who these baddies are, but they don't know you. They don't know me, and they underestimate our capability. And throughout history, we've had great people come from nowhere to do awesome unbelievable things.
Mm.
Absolute impossible things that you know are amazing, you know, on world levels and changes. And
yeah, there are a lot of people in the world that are amazing that are fighting for us.
Yep. And I just people are uniting around, but it's to get the voice out, our voice. And if anybody needs a voice, it's the people.
Isn't that funny?
It's just, you know, and the voice and the song, you know, and I love that song that John Farnham did, and it is very meaningful.
Yeah.
But then the ABC go and, you know, and use it, and that was against, and they're not supposed to do that at all for the Yes campaign. Oh, and Qantas, don't always go back. But well, it is a very vital, and on the 14th of October, I can tell everyone out there, if you're listening, if you go in and you must vote no. There's only one way to answer the referendum, and if you doubt anything, go and listen to Jacinda Price.
Totally.
So.
There you have it. You said it.
Yeah. Mm. It's just something. I always say I'm not going to talk about it, and, you know, and I do. Mm. But anyway, lots of things going on. Very happy with my life. I'd be happy if I was flying, but, you know, if I really need to and I get withdrawal symptoms, I've always got Jeffrey. So we're most probably going to go for a fly on Sunday.
Nice.
Just a little one round the Glasshouse Mountains.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
You mentioned at the start about your solo flight across the Pacific.
Oh, yeah, what a doozy. You know, it's just one of those things. You know, Dad I suppose I'd never mentioned Jim Hazelton. And by the way, our family come from, I was reading the family history today, convicts.
Mm-hmm.
No wonder the father of the guy I married didn't want to come to the wedding. He wouldn't come because I was a convict descendant.
Wow.
English peer. There you go.
Wow.
Anyway, so your what was your question now? Gosh, I...
The flight across the Pacific.
Oh, the flight.
Mm.
Well, it started in there were two airplanes to ferry back. I think Dad was bringing a 402, and we left. We tanked the airplanes in a place called Hollister, which is right out just out of San Francisco, and in near San Jose.
What year are we talking?
Oh, in the 84, 85.
Okay.
And my logbook, sadly, is the beginning, first logbook is back in Cambodia.
Okay.
So I'm going to have to go and get that if I go any to get anything. And that flight, we flew over, and it was my brother Martin who was with Ansett Aviation. He was an Airbus first officer. And he sadly passed away. Everyone in aviation, one of the nicest blokes you'd ever meet, just like my dad, just and a real lovely guy. Sadly, cancer got him. Thought he beat it once and then got it, and that was it. But anyway, Marty was a young up-and-coming pilot, and I think he'd just started his own ferry company with Dad, and so they had two airplanes to bring back from America. And they said, oh, well, you can bring the Seneca. So we tanked the Seneca in Torrance Airport. It was Torrance, not Hollister. Torrance. And then I was flying all over the place, you know, getting bits and pieces for the airplane, you know. But American and flying airport, they make it just so easy.
Mm.
And I'll never forget coming in, landing and picking up this part. And it was called Millionaire Aviation. And they rolled out, you know, I'm only in a little 182. Oh, and I was just about to take off in the airport. And there was an earthquake. And the whole runway just, this is in San Francisco, the whole runway just moved in front of me like a wave.
Wow.
And you know, no camera, sadly. You know, you just, no video, you know, like you do. And anyway, so that was the start. Anyway, they had to do a runway sweep and check everything and go back and wait for an hour. And then I went and, you know, took off, got the bits. And the Millionaire, they lined out this red carpet. And I went, whoa. I said, who do you think I am? And they said, oh, no, we do this to everybody. And they do the windows and, you know, did the tyres, just like you pulled up in the service station, the good old service. And I went, wow, this is great. So anyway, took off, got the bits and pieces, went back and tanked the aeroplanes out, got them certified, tanked and then certified. And then I was on my own, and Martin and Dad were in the Jim Hassel were in the other aeroplane. And I took off first, and we had to wait. First couple of days we couldn't go because it was a long leg to Honolulu, and it was about 13, 14 hours. And the winds were not favourable, and that distance and the fuel we had, it was not possible. So waited until, you know, we got a better wind.
It wasn't possible for you to reach Hawaii?
No, couldn't do it.
Hmm.
So I made the decision, you know, when the winds got a bit better, and Dad and I both agreed, so we did the flight planning and we took off, and he took off a little bit after me because his aeroplane's a bit faster. And I never made contact with him the whole way.
Oh, really?
But
so you didn't even see him?
No. We didn't even fly in formation, but took off the Golden Gate Bridge. Oh, and the fog underneath it. And, you know, and you've got an aeroplane that's so goddamn full of fuel.
Heavy.
And heavy. And I'll never forget that left turn. Yeah, you know, and the runway, you know, taking off and then she's lifting. Oh. You know, there's nothing like the feeling. And then you get airborne and then you start to bank real slow. And it was a turbocharged Seneca 2, good aeroplane. And then, you know, moving along, checking the winds, and my ADF never worked.
Mm.
Luckily, we were testing a guy called Greg Hoare, who sadly disappeared in a ferry flight, but brilliant minded engineer and avionics. He came up, he worked for Magnavox in Torrance, and he came up with the portable GPS system. And Dad was trialing these, and they gave me one, and you have a trailing antenna and a box, and you just put lat and long in and this thing. But I used that, and plus dead reckoning, you know, what's there to go to find on the way?
Mm.
None of the GPS as we've got now, none of the flight systems, just maps, charts, nothing but, digital except this unit. And luckily it worked. It was very accurate. But I got about, it was dark, it was about 8 o'clock at night. Weather was okay.
So you're heading across the water to Hawaii in the dark by yourself?
Yeah. But, and that was a 14-hour leg, and it was over 14, and my fuel was running really low. Now, the guy that sent me solo went in that drink at that stage 3 times. Now, I'm not kidding. Mm-hmm. And, Ray, if you're out there and you hear this, and he's still alive to tell the story on the third one. But anyway, so I made the decision to go to Hilo, which was just a little closer, and I got in with about 15 minutes of fuel left.
In the dark?
Yeah, in the dark, but, you know. It's
by yourself.
15 minutes. Yeah. So then trying to fix this ADF, so we took it to this guy that, I mean, Dad knew. Dad could turn up in any airport in the world and people would know him. So this old bloke called Wally Waterhouse in Honolulu. So they did the test. They said they fixed the ADF. We had 2 days.
Non-aviators, the ADF is?
Automatic direction finder. Because before these came along, they had a device called a Lorant, which would be run off ships.
Mm.
And... but the ADF, there's a ground-based aid, but in the ocean it's pretty difficult. So that's when the Loran comes into it. But the islands have all got these because they're long-range navigation. They're better than a visual omni-range, which is another type of navigation device. But, like, no, none of these smart GPSs that we've got now, computers in the aeroplane.
The GPS has made us lazy.
Ah. Global positioning system, I guess you could call it the goopy pilot syndrome or something like that, that acronym. Anyway, so but I never saw my father. Oh, no, he took off and we're in virtually formation then for a little bit out of Honolulu, and the ADF still didn't work, the automatic direction finder. So I just went, nah, she'll be right. So we kept on, we went to Johnson Island and did fly over Johnson Island, which you're not allowed to because it's a military base and it's top security. But, of course, you know, had to do a little circle over there, and I wanted to check the MDB on the ground, talk to the people there and get some bearings and see what it was doing. And then head off to the next island, which was Honiara in the Gilbert Islands. No, sorry, Majuro. Yeah, Majuro. And that was like a little atoll. And that was another long leg, 8-9 hours. And it was there was a storm, so I had to fly lower because I, you know, didn't want to be in the clouds and, you know, rough ride. So thinned the fuel out. And it was just getting dark. But again, it was that portable GPS that saved the day. And... at one stage there, I watched it go on the next leg from east to west.
Yeah,
and
wow.
It changed 180. Mm. And I thought, what a great bit of gear.
Mm.
So it got me into Majuro.
So you were flying under the weather, like, what, 500 feet above the water?
Yeah, and I could it was all dead reckoning as well because I was looking at the cloud shadows on the ocean and then, you know, the wind speed, you know, based on the tips on the ocean and that sort of thing, you know, just common sense stuff everyone should know about.
Mm.
And especially pilots. And then we had another look at the ADF and refueled and then went off the next day, and the next one was Honiara, of which I remember the natives put on a lovely show, but I was so exhausted, I think I was sitting on a grass mat, you know, going almost, I was asleep sitting up because we had a very early start the next morning. And Honiara was and then to Brisbane.
Wow.
So, it had to come.
Did you have an autopilot?
No.
So how did you go to the toilet?
I have the world's strongest bladder.
Okay.
But I had a bucket. But you'll laugh, I took with me a crash axe and a little hammer.
Mm-hmm.
With a little point. And that sat beside me with my life vest, just in case. The aircraft out of Honiara started to smoke a bit. I could see some smoke, you know, and I wasn't full of fuel. And there was a possibility, and, you know, and Dad had told me the story of the guy who, you know, who who crashed in Honiara on a ferry flight. You know, a little cheery story to cheer me up.
Thanks, Dad.
And then I looked out the back, you know, because I'm always looking behind to see if there was, you know, everything was okay. And the smoke just stopped. So I, you know.
Unknown.
No. Yeah, it might have been a little bit of residual oil because of the turbocharger.
Mm.
And then, of course, coming into the final leg and Sydney, oh, no, it was Brisbane, straight to Brisbane and then routed down to Sydney. And the buggers made me hold at...
How dare they?
hold. And it was freezing. I was freezing because I had this little pair of shorts on. And anyway, then when I landed in Sydney, they made me put a whole can of that stuff in the aeroplane.
Oh, but being
typical Hazleton, I let it go for 2 minutes and then threw it out the window.
Mm.
And cleared immigration. And then outside was a dear longtime girlfriend who met me with a bunch of flowers.
Wow.
But apart from that, it was most probably one of the, could have been a world record breaking fast trip, but she was about the only one that knew about it,
mm.
you know, and the family. And it was considered that's what you do, that's what your job was. Oh, God. Some of the things, yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, pretty amazing the places I lived. I've lived in Africa. Gosh, lived in Jinja, source of the Nile. My sister was just there last week. She did an African holiday. Yes. So,
well, hopefully you'll have written a book soon.
Yeah, got a, you know, I got boxes. I've got a 3-bay shed. And it is full of boxes that I've lugged around and photographs. And, yeah, so I guess now's the opportunity to do something. Now, they wrote the family, and I supplied a lot of photos for the book, my dad's story where everybody's written about his flying career, and it's called Born to Fly.
Okay.
And it's a good story. And... but, yeah, I'd love to get my own story out there. And
it's a great story.
There's loads more, and there's so much. Look, I just feel very lucky.
You've led an adventurous lifestyle.
Yes, married to the penniless peer, flying the world's first turboprop airliner, a flight in a jet from one island to to another in some of the most intense weather.
Mm.
But, look. Look at these guys did in the beginning in aviation, how they created all of this just with guts and, you know, in those days you were not only a pilot, you were an engineer, navigator, you knew everything.
Mm.
So those guys in the early days, I thank them all. You know, even our Bert Hinkler and just even Hargraves, you know, for kites and his ability. We had some very clever people here in the beginning to do with flying. But I did, when I lived in America for 4 years, and I did go to Kitty Hawk, and I ran up and down that strip where Wilbur did his flight.
Wow.
Yeah. Yes, so, and it's, the adventures are not over yet.
No.
I feel, you
good,
know.
Good on you for doing them.
Yeah. So anyone wants to give me a job, contact you, contact me.
Okay.
I'm ready to go. Okay.
All right, Wendy. Well, what an awesome story. Thank you.
Okay.
And have a nice weekend with your grandchild. And
yes, no, yeah, got the march on Friday.
Yep.
Got the talks on Sunday.
Yep.
And pick up the toilet on Sunday. Maybe a bit of flying on, toilet on Monday and flying on Sunday. There you go.
Awesome.
Okay, well, over and out. We'll talk to you next time.
Yep, thank you.
Okay, all the best to you.
See you later.
Okay, bye.
Bye-bye.